There's a book that reviewers are calling The Da Vinci Code for Kids. It's a story about ancient manuscripts, old libraries, magic, and a 12-year-old boy. Matthew Skelton's debut novel, Endymion Spring, takes readers on a dark and magical journey from the shelves of Oxford's Bodleian Library to the workshop of Johann Gutenberg in 15th-century Germany. It's taken Skelton himself from rags to riches, literally. Skelton had a Ph.D. in English history, no job, and was living out of a suitcase in a borrowed room when his manuscript was plucked out of a slush pile, sold for a six-figure advance, and optioned for a movie. And Strange Champs asked Skelton how the story came to him.
Not many people believe me when I say this, but the book actually started with a dream that I had. I'd always been a very studious boy. I was always reading and studying and working hard, and I got to Oxford, which was a dream come true, to read for my PhD in English, and I picked up Philip Pullman's The Subtle Knife, and it was incredible for me because I was reading it in North Oxford, and it's a book about Oxford and parallel universes in Oxford. And it was sensational because I was in bed reading this book and the main character was walking down my street towards a parallel universe at the same time that I was reading it. And I just thought, I never, ever want to work in academia again. I just want to stay in children's books. It was magical. And that night, I actually had a dream in which a boy was trapped in a library with a dark, sinister figure. And I knew that this boy was in trouble and that he needed my help. So I woke up with this definite sense that I dreamt the end of a book. All I had to do was figure out how he got there and what would happen.
It strikes me that the book you've written is a book that had to be written by someone who loves books, since a book, and in fact the whole history of printing, is at the heart of this story. What made you want to create a children's book that would revolve around books and printing presses and ancient manuscripts?
There was this wonderful professor in Oxford, and sadly he has died now, but he's this wonderful legendary figure, really, in book history. And this man had this shock of white hair, and he'd sort of bounce into a room, and he was so excited, he would hug himself. He just loved what he was doing. And in the first class of every year, he would actually bring a blank book in, a book that was completely blank, and he'd say, "Now read this." He was teaching us that you can actually read a book with much more than your eyes. You read it with your fingers, you read it with your nose. A blank book, a book without words, can actually teach you a great deal about when it was published, how it was printed even. It was a wonderful experience. So I think his inspiration also caused the book to happen.
Well, tell me about the book that your character, Blake, discovers, because it's at the heart of the story.
That's true. The Oxford part of my story begins with a young boy called Blake, who's 12 years old or so, and he's in Oxford with his mum, and he's waiting for her in this wonderful college library full of old books, and he's running his fingers backwards and forwards along the shelves, quite bored, and then one of the books strikes him back, and it draws blood, so there's blood dripping down his finger, and the book responsible is a battered brown volume, and inside, the pages are blank, and they move, as if alive. Yet as this boy, this chosen boy, looks more carefully inside the book, words do appear, and they're words that only he can see, and they're words that have been waiting for him to find them for 550 years, and they tell the legend of the printing press and a dark, sinister history that surrounds it, and the story of Endymion Spring.
What sort of book is this? Blake turned over one page, and then another, and another, looking for a way into the story, but he couldn't find one. There were no words to guide him, only a series of blank pages that led like a spiral staircase into the unknown. He let his mind follow them for a while, wondering where they would go, but they seemed to be leading nowhere, over and over again. He felt disappointed and yet exhilarated, too, as though he had embarked on a quest to find something. What was he looking for, and how would he know when he found it? He was just an ordinary boy who wasn't particularly good at reading, and yet he felt certain that the more he explored, the deeper he delved, the more likely he was to uncover something, some secret encoded in the paper, perhaps, that would lead to an even greater discovery. But how, he wondered, could anyone read a blank book? In the end, he closed the volume and returned it to the shelf, little realizing that the story was already writing itself.
Oh, it gives me chills already. Now, to uncover the mystery of this book that Blake finds, this requires kind of going back in time to the very origins of printing. I can't think of another children's book in which somebody like Johann Gutenberg figures as a character. Tell me something more about the history of the printing press.
What's fascinating, and what I just couldn't believe, is there's this genuine legend that existed for two centuries that another man might have invented the idea of the printing press first, a man called Lawrence Koster, and he came from Haarlem in Holland. And it's a wonderful story. He was supposedly out walking in some woods, and he discovered this magnificent beech tree, and he decided to carve some letters from the alphabet from the bark of this tree as a sort of toy for his grandchildren. But these pieces of bark bled sap into his handkerchief, and he thought, well, why not print books using movable pieces of wooden type? But this is where the story gets dark, because actually, historically, there is a man called Johann Fust, and he was the man who backed Gutenberg and the printing press in Mainz. But there's this apocryphal legend that Johann Fust might have actually been connected to Koster, and while Koster was at midnight mass, Johann Fust stole the man's idea and equipment from him and took it to Mainz. But for two centuries, people weren't certain whether Johann Fust was Faust. And Faust, of course, is the man who sold his soul to the devil for all the knowledge and experience in the world. And it's this sort of
wonderful
magical
legend.
It's lovely, isn't it? And it's true. You read these 300-year-old books and you just see Johann Fust, or was it Faust? I got goosebumps and I thought, wow, this is so astonishing. This is so dark and mysterious that it just took over my book and new things started to happen.
Mainz, Germany, 1452. Johann Fust arrived on a cold winter's night. While most of the city slept under a mantle of softly falling snow, he bribed the sentries to open the iron gate near the river and advanced unobserved through the streets. His footsteps scrunched the snow. Letting out a long, silver breath, Fust cut across an empty square towards the lanes and alleys that crisscrossed behind the market like fractured glass.
Was it hard to imagine and recreate life in 15th century Germany?
It was and it wasn't. Kids are asking me, well, what's my favorite part of the book? And I always tell them that if you turn to page 251, you'll see my favorite page. And on this page, there are some skeletons engaged in a dance. And this is called the Dance of Death. And I remember this was also new to me. I just discovered in a book on Gutenberg this description of the Dance of Death, which was a medieval festival, a celebration. Curiously enough, it's a celebration of life. The people would actually leave their houses and they'd dress up, sometimes as the Pope or as knights and queens and kings, and then skeletons would chase them through the streets of medieval cities.
Without warning, a devil sprinted past the window and performed a grotesque gyrating dance in the middle of the street. Almost immediately after, a procession of unsightly skeletons started walking along the straw-strewn streets, knocking on the walls of the surrounding houses, summoning the living to join the dead. Come one! Come all, they sang, ladder pipes, viols, lutes and lyres, all belched and thrummed as madrigals began to weave in and out of the crowd, singing at the top of their voices. King or queen, pope or knight, each lies equal in God's sight. Judge, lawyer, doctor, fool, none escapes death's final rule.
And they would end up having to die in the graveyard, sort of a thematic death, sort of a ceremonial death. They'd all lie down one next to the other, and then the band would strike up and play, and they'd sort of be resurrected. I think that, for me, is one of the most exciting and best parts of the book, just because it's so full of colour and atmosphere and life.
One of the things I really love about your character, Blake, is that you made him, I think he describes himself as an ordinary boy who isn't even particularly good at reading. I really love it that this kid who's chosen by a magical book actually struggles with reading himself and doesn't especially love books. Why did you make that decision?
I was Blake when I was a boy. I've always loved books. I've, in a sense, collected books, but I was a reluctant reader in some ways. I would own books. I would look through them. I would love them and smell them and put them on my shelf. But I'm an incredibly slow reader, and I was surrounded by kids who could read much faster and much better than I could. So I identify very much with my character, Blake. I just identify with him so much. So I'll defend him to my dying day, because I think he's a wonderful, sensitive young boy who deserves, and hopefully will have, especially young readers who will be his friend, who will feel like him, that maybe they're not the fastest readers, maybe they're not the most avid readers, but they still believe in the imagination, in the power of going beyond just the words on the page, but bring them to life in their minds with their imaginations.
Matthew, I have the sense that Blake's adventures may not be done.
There is room, definitely, for a sequel, and maybe one day, just maybe, I'll find the right story to tell.
That's Matthew Skelton, talking with Anne Strangehams about his debut children's book, Endymion Spring.